Thanks very much.
One of my main intentions this afternoon is to encourage any of you who haven't read this particular novel to read it, and possibly to encourage those who have read it some time ago to reread 1984. Could I start by asking how many people have actually read it? It would be useful in the course of discussion if there's some awareness of who has read 1984. There's a show of hands. Almost everyone, far too. Yeah, virtually everyone. I mean, it's worth knowing anyway. It removes the need to concentrate too much on saying very much about the plot and so on, were I to have done so otherwise. Let me, however, start just by refreshing your memory, because I suspect that some of you may not have read the book that recently. It's the kind of book whose popularity encourages people to have read it, perhaps at an early stage, and therefore it may be some time ago since you've read the book. So I'll start just by reading the opening section, because it is, as far as novels go, a fairly dramatic opening to a novel. And of course, the first few paragraphs do contain in distilled form many of the key concepts that recur repeatedly throughout the rest of the novel. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his breast in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. The hallway smelt of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, a coloured poster, too large for indoor display, had been tacked to the wall. It depicted simply an enormous face, more than a metre wide. The face of a man of about 45, with a heavy black moustache and ruggedly handsome features. Winston made for the stairs. It was no use trying the lift. Even at the best of times, it was seldom working, and at present the electric current was cut off during daylight hours. It was part of the economy drive in preparation for Hate Week. The flat was 7 flights up, and Winston, who was 39 and had a varicose ulcer above his right ankle, went slowly, resting several times on the way. On each landing opposite the lift shaft, the poster with the enormous face gazed from the wall. It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you about when you move. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption beneath it ran. Already you can see from those opening lines that despite several of the futuristic references, clearly, the novel contains much in it which is going to be a critique or a satire on the conditions when Orwell was himself writing, not in 1984, but in 1948 and 49. And in fact, it's that aspect of the novel, on a closer inspection, which perhaps is at least as valuable to us today, in political terms, compared with Orwell's prognosis for the future. In this novel, there are a number of things which socialists will probably like, and a number which they will dislike. And I wish to divide my comments quite simply into these categories of the positive and negative aspects of this work, as I would interpret it. On the positive side, then, firstly, and perhaps possibly least controversially, I would regard this work as something of a masterpiece in literary terms. In stylistic terms, I think there are few who would be anxious to deny that the book is gripping. It certainly holds the attention. It's extremely well written. It's stood the test of time in that respect. And it's poetically structured. So in literary terms, and we needn't dwell on this very long because this afternoon's discussion is not intended to be framed around literary merits or otherwise of this work, but let us just dwell briefly upon the fact that in literary terms, I would contend at least, that it is an excellent book. So that no doubt would appeal to socialists as to others. Secondly, as I've already touched upon, the book can be read as a criticism of mid-20th century British capitalism, plain and simple. Already there have been some references to the poverty of working class life, the lifts that don't work, the 7 flights up, the smell of boiled cabbage. All of this clearly is hardly futuristic in tone. There is also, of course, the great weight of criticism throughout this book of political hypocrisy, which those of us, all of us living in capitalism, not in 1984, but in 1994, are only too well aware of. Also, many references to the poverty of working class existence, numerous references to war, the horrors of warfare. And perhaps most powerfully of all, references to the cultural sickness which Orwell saw all around him and saw getting worse. It's often described as a nightmare vision. It's often been described as exaggerated and unrealistic, as a picture of the future. But in fact, any glance through the catalogues of horror described by organisations such as Amnesty International show that the kind of imagination that Orwell put into this work is hardly that far removed from the kind of conditions imposed upon human beings, not just in that period, but of course today, and in many cases, even more so today. It's also been well catalogued how many of his predictions in this book have, in a sense, come true. Perhaps the most obvious gimmicky reference that people recall is that of the telescreens, the television screen dominating every room in every place, public or private, which is not only forcibly watched by the subjects, but in fact is a two-way device which can be watching the people themselves. And although this clearly hasn't happened in those terms, again, it's not that far removed. There are many cases now, and we see them in public places, of cameras which are indeed set up in tube stations and elsewhere, which have 24-hour surveillance of the public as they walk through. So in fact, the technology, which didn't exist in his day, has indeed come about and is starting to be used for political purposes. He captures the essence of working class alienation in a very positive and immediate sense. Within the opening pages of the book, he states that nothing was your own except the few cubic centimetres inside your skull. At an early stage too, the theme of betrayal rears its head to become one of the major themes of this book. Early in the first section of the book, but it's divided into three sections, there is a quite powerful image of some three previous party leaders who have since been disgraced and have been tortured and have been forced to betray their previous principles. And they're being allowed to live out their days in dignity, in a small cafe reserved for the purpose. And the refrain keeps playing up through the telescreen of an old song, the original song, "Under the Spreading Chestnut Tree, I Love You and You Love Me." But the words have been changed. "Under the spreading chestnut tree, I sold you and you sold me." The idea being that they've betrayed one another. And of course, since I'm not spoiling the plot for anyone, because I think virtually all of you have read the book, but of course the sad climax to the work is that Winston and Julia indeed are forced to betray each other in the most symbolic way. Not just to betray each other in words, but to really, in their own minds have been convinced to betray one another and to betray their principles in a very profound way, not just in a superficial way. And clearly this becomes, in a sense, the main theme of the work, and it reflects Orwell's own deep pessimism at the time he was writing the work. He felt that principles he had some attachment to during the course of his life had been deeply betrayed. He felt a profound sense of disillusion, and this reflects itself through the personal betrayal that Winston and Julia are forced to undergo. Other political predictions and political commentary that is contained within the work, again, extremely pertinent. For example, the way in which the three superpowers who control the world are constantly being realigned, and each time that they change sides with one another as regards who their enemy is, the past is obliterated, and they act as if this has always been their ally and that has always been their enemy. So that when East Asia changes to Eurasia as the main enemy of Oceania, all previous records are destroyed and people are forced to believe that this has always been the case. And of course this directly reflects the zigzag realignment that took place just prior to the Second World War, in the early stages of the Second World War. And Orwell's particular interest in this matter would have stemmed from the way in which the communist parties of the West actually indulged in precisely the same so-called double thing as regards the which side of the war they and Russia was going to be fighting on. Orwell doesn't shrink from using the term socialism to apply it to the regime in question. Indeed, the regime which is described in his book is referred to as INGSOC, short for English Socialism. And in this sense, the book clearly is a quite open parody on, either one could read it as a parody on Bolshevism or even at times British Labourism, but leftism in general, which Orwell was quite happy to use the term socialism in relation to. And his elaboration of the concept of doublethink, and he spends many pages explaining this subtle philosophical concept of doublethink, but it does indeed read at times as a striking summary of the meanderings of the communist parties in the way in which they were defending their contradictions throughout that period. He shows a good understanding of state capitalism in many ways. For example, and I quote, "The so-called abolition of private property, which took place in the middle years of the century, meant in effect the concentration of property in far fewer hands than before, but with this difference, that the new owners were a group instead of a mass of individuals." This clearly is a good summary of the way in which state capitalism has functioned. In other respects, however, his understanding is confused and very weak. He wastes several pages on a very confused and, I would say, misguided elaboration of the theory of a war economy, which has Trotskyist origins and doesn't seem to relate to any solid evidence. The idea basically being that wars are fought within capitalism for almost conspiratorial reasons in order to consciously use up surplus wealth which would otherwise cause problems. And this doesn't seem to hold water. But perhaps most importantly of all, Orwell's main political weakness from beginning to end is that he has no concept of socialism, no positive concept of socialism, which goes beyond the frustrations and the contradictions of state capitalism. He reaches out, struggles in vain, but doesn't actually set his hand upon any alternative concept of socialism beyond the one which he is spending his time grappling with and criticising and satirising. So far I've said that the good points of this work are in its literary style and in its criticisms of present-day British 20th century capitalism, and thirdly, in its criticisms of the left. Fourthly, the book is extremely useful as a weapon in the battle against the culture of capitalism. Let me give a few examples of how Orwell uses his writing ability to satirise not some futuristic nightmare concept of totalitarian dictatorship, but the mundane and impoverished life of mid-20th century English capitalism. "Here," he says, "were produced," he's referring to a department in 1984's Ministry of Truth, "here were produced rubbishy newspapers containing almost nothing except sport, crime and astrology, sensational 5-cent novelettes, films oozing with set, and sentimental songs which were composed entirely by mechanical means on a special kind of kaleidoscope known as a versificator." He later goes into the mechanics of this particular machine, which is used to churn out songs for the consumption of the proles. And again, this bears some resemblance to what is happening at the present time. He describes the environmental poverty that people were suffering. "The plaster," he says, "flaked constantly from ceilings and walls. The pipes burst in every hard frost. The roof leaked whenever there was snow. The heating system was usually running at half steam when it was not closed down altogether from motives of economy." He goes into great detail about the rationing, the announcements from the telestream about whether or not the chocolate ration would be increased by a few milligrams. In addition to all of that, he has a very interesting line in criticism in this book against the kind of political dogmatism which he found around him on the left, and particularly in the Communist Party. And of course, his experiences in the Spanish Civil War in Catalonia really brought this to a head and bore witness to his doubts about dogmatism on the left. At one stage, for example, Winston Smith is in the canteen and he hears a loyal party cadre speaking incessantly, and he says that he lost track of what the person was saying. All he knew was that they were religiously defending the latest orthodox line which they had been fed. And he sits and listens in wonderment to this person who's simply repeating clichés and dogmatic orthodoxies to his heart's content without thinking about what he's saying. Winston had a curious feeling that this was not a real human being but some kind of dummy. It was not the man's brain that was speaking, but his larynx. The stuff that was coming out of him consisted of words, but it was not speech in the true sense. It was a noise uttered in unconsciousness, like the quacking of a duck. The description of state capitalism, insofar as that's what it is, can be read, of course, as a warning of the dangers of state capitalist dictatorship, which masquerades under the name of socialism. To that extent, the book can be seen pure and simply as a critique of the Russian state capitalist empire. In addition to this, however, Orwell showed some understanding of the psychology of repression. He puts great emphasis, and this distinguishes the book from other works of political criticism in the fictional sphere of the time. He puts great emphasis on the role of psychological submissiveness in upholding a repressive political regime. There's the curious role, for example, of O'Brien, who eventually turns out to be the chief persecutor and prosecutor of the book's hero. O'Brien nevertheless commands a strange respect from Winston Smith, indeed at times it's actually said love, from his victim, as they appear to stand trapped in a symbiotic balance. And in this respect, Orwell seems to have owed some debt to the ideas of writers such as Erich Fromm. And even at one point, Wilhelm Reich, in fact there's one section in the book which reads almost line for line as if it's been lifted from the works of Wilhelm Reich. And I was surprised by this. I was just checking the other day the dates of publication, which I wasn't aware of, but in fact I was surprised to find that Wilhelm Reich's work did indeed appear significantly before 1984 was published in English, in translation, and therefore it's quite feasible, I imagine, that this was a direct reference. He says, all this marching up and down and cheering and waving flags is simply sex gone sour. If you're happy inside yourself, why should you get excited about Big Brother and the three-year plans and the 2 minutes hate and all the rest of their bloody rot? And what this is in the context of is explaining why it is that the party is undergoing a programme of sexual repression. The idea is, as I say, this comes directly from Reich in all probability, that by repressing that sex is being re-expressed as loyalty to the regime. Now, I've touched on a number of points which I felt that socialists may regard as positive and interesting and useful about this work. I'd like to go on now, predictively, but symmetrically at least, to the bad points, as I would see it, of this book, the flaws, the problems, the kind of things which a critical reading will show up as being somewhat more unfortunate in the book's content. Above all, the book is defeatist, it's pessimistic, it betrays a belief in the possibility of the working class being permanently malleable, a working class response to the indignities and poverties of capitalism being not just temporarily, but permanently submissive. And this, clearly, from a socialist reading, must be the starting point for any criticism of this book. Orwell had an unusual background in India and is often described as being of the lower middle class. In present-day terms, it's perhaps hard to categorise this in this post-imperial period. Others may have more to say about the precise class nature of Orwell's origins in the British Raj and so on in India and his background. I would suppose that Orwell was ultimately a member of the working class, certainly in the sense that he didn't possess substantial capital. But for all that, he clearly was somewhat distanced from the statistically average norm of working class life. And his images of working class life show this. He always seems to be writing somehow at one step removed, with sometimes great detail and great understanding, but nevertheless always a tendency towards a patronising image of working class existence. Orwell once complained that Dickens, in his novels, failed to ever include portraits of members of the working class. And in the very first talk of this particular series, the speaker quoted Orwell commenting on Dickens in the following terms. The ordinary town proletariat, the people who make the wheels go round, have always been ignored by novelists. When they do find their way between the covers of a book, it's nearly always as objects of pity or comic relief. The central action of Dickens' stories almost invariably takes place in middle-class surroundings. He has no portrait of an agricultural worker, and only one of an industrial worker. Now, this was Orwell complaining about Dickens failing to include the working class in his novels. Orwell clearly did include many members of the working class, but his workers, and certainly in 1984, the class of people referred to as the proles, retained their humanity only by allowing themselves to remain submerged from any political activity. They offer no hope of real change whatsoever. The portraits he offers of the working class, not just in 1984, but in his other novels, are often very unrounded. They're not rounded portraits. They don't include political vitality or activity or any serious possibility of change. There's one picture that comes to mind from 1984 of a great robust woman with brawny red forearms, and he describes her three or four times. He keeps seeing her out of a window, or Winston Smith keeps seeing her out of a window, and she's singing the same song endlessly. And it's a very unrealistic, in some ways, picture of a member of the working class, and it does betray something of Orwell's view on that matter. Now, in the latter stages of this book, and bear in mind that Orwell died less than a year after he wrote it, Orwell is going through a constant frenetic debate in his mind, a very troubled debate about the possibility of serious political change brought about by the workers themselves. He says twice, for example, in the book, if there was hope, it lay in the proles. And he goes on, sooner or later it would happen. Strength would change into consciousness. In the end, their awakening would come. And until that happened, though it might be 1,000 years, they would stay alive against all the odds, like birds passing on from body to body the vitality which the party did not share and could not kill. In a separate section, he says again, the proles, if only they could somehow become conscious of their own strength, would have no need to conspire. They needed only to rise up and shake themselves like a horse, shaking off flies. If they chose, they could blow the party to pieces tomorrow morning. Surely, sooner or later, it must occur to them to do it. And yet, and of course he adds this, and yet, because he has grave doubts about anything happening. The point is that the conclusion of the book is unmistakably defeatist. It's true that this could be read as a warning of the results of inactivity, but Orwell is pretty clear that he's given up hope. It's ironic, of course, that the totalitarian regime which he was so directly satirising in this work was indeed eventually overthrown by the so-called proles there around 1990, some 40 years after he was writing. His conclusion is clear. He says in the final pages, or at least through O'Brien, he says in the final pages of the book, there is no way in which the party can be overthrown. The rule of the party is forever. I said earlier that the work was poetic, and one way in which this manifests itself is that there are several phrases which recur repeatedly through the book. One is, we shall meet in the place where there is no darkness. This comment is made no less than 3 times at different stages in the book. And it seems to carry within it some hope, but it turns out that the place in question is merely the Ministry of Love, which has no windows, just a constant electric light, and in which the speciality is torture. Again, on several separate occasions in the book, the phrase recurs, we are the dead, meaning that any of the rebels in this regime are basically signing their death warrants the moment they begin to rebel. And perhaps the most famous quotation from the book, if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. Perhaps this was a somewhat forgivable depression that Orwell was going through in the wake of Nazism, Russian state capitalism, and in the years immediately following the Second World War. And yet, in a sense, it's not forgivable, because his view of socialism never stepped itself beyond the travesties of the state capitalist model, which he so hated. He, in fact, was a victim of his own unrelenting unwillingness to reject the human nature theory, his own refusal to accept the possibility of genuine socialism without any state control whatsoever. This was an idea which clearly, like so many others on the left, he regarded as unworkable, or at least not worthy of detailed consideration. And as a result, he became a victim of his own ideological trap, in which state capitalism was simply there for him to lash out at without anything to put in its place. He says at one stage, the place where there is no darkness was the imagined future, which one would never see, but which by foreknowledge one could mystically share in. Perhaps 1,000 years hence, in other words, socialism for him would be possible. As I say, he died less than a year after he wrote the book. In fact, he was seriously ill whilst he wrote it, and the book itself was finished in hospital. But we, nevertheless, have to judge the work on its literary or political merits rather than simply taking recourse to his particular state of health at the time. There are other flaws in the work. There's a recurrent mysticism which keeps cropping up, which, in a sense, is surprising in such a straightforward thinker as Orwell. But there's a powerful irrationality running through the work. Strands of ineffective but symbolic resistance. dreams, for example, on several occasions, which the character has, are later repeated in reality, without any particular explanation for this. The regime obliterates all records of past history in order for it to control progress into the future, which itself is an unlikely possibility, bearing in mind that they have to rewrite every newspaper that's ever been written each time they decide something happened differently from how it really happened. But perhaps even more unlikely is the counterpoint to this, because what Orwell argues is that although the regime is busily destroying all records so that they can control the minds of the population, that alongside this, there is what he calls an ancestral memory. And this recurs repeatedly. Indeed, the phrase ancestral memory appears at least twice in the book. What he's saying is that there's a kind of vast collective unconscious, perhaps owing something there to the ideas of Jung, in which, however much the regime improbably destroys all records of the past, people somehow keep within them memories of how life used to be lived two or three generations previously, almost inheriting in their brains the ideas of their grandparents without necessarily having spoken to them about it. Again, this to me, it seems, and others may wish to disagree in discussion, but this seems to me sheer rubbish. It's nonsense. It's completely irrational mythology, and it really doesn't hold water as a serious analysis, even if it may be somewhat entertaining to some in a novel. It's a mystical supposition. A further flaw, and this relates back to his relation to the working class itself, is the role of women in this book is severely lacking. The heroine opposite the hero, Winston Smith, Julia, is described by Winston, her partner in crime, at one stage, as being only a rebel from the waist downwards. He accuses her of being a sexual rebel and nothing more. Repeatedly, when he's discussing with her the importance of having a political critique of the regime, it's said that Julia turns off or falls asleep or doesn't appear to quite comprehend what he's talking about. And he rather patronisingly says, well, she's quite a good rebel nevertheless, she's got quite good guts. Bearing in mind that she's in fact the only female character of any significance in the book, and indeed its heroine, it doesn't really say a great deal for Orwell's image of women's participation in struggle. Finally, on the question of power, which is really what, for Orwell, the book was all about, he makes the assumption, and this becomes clear at the end of the book, that power is held onto for its own sake, rather than for economic and social advantage within a given historical context. He has the idea that in 1984, and indeed in the world in general, there is a seeking after power purely for its own sake, not for any of the side advantages that it might bring. The problem with this is that it lacks historical context. In actual fact, power, of course, is sought passionately by classes in history and by individuals at times, but it's sought usually because it has benefits, not simply because it has some abstract attraction of its own. In other words, power takes place within a certain social context. There's no point in having power in a society, for example, if for some reason all of the wealth and services you might require were simply unavailable or non-existent. The power would become redundant. So he lacks historical context. In this sense, he lacks historical understanding and imagination. There's this thing called the book, produced by a possibly imaginary organisation called the Brotherhood in 1984. And the book supposedly contains all the secrets of the regime. And he's reading the book, and it describes how the regime functions. And it comes to a dramatic part in the book. It says, this is the how. This is how we oppress the vast majority. But why? Why do we do it? And then he falls asleep. By the time he wakes up to reread the mysterious section about why, he gets captured by the thought police. But he does eventually find out the answer. Right at the end of the book, his tormentor, O'Brien, with whom he has a love-hate relationship, actually says to him, I'll tell you why. The party holds on to power purely for power's sake. We carry on, we obliterate people's memories, we obliterate all records, purely because that's what we're doing. There's another very poetic part, but it reflects this idea about history having stopped still, the sort of non-historical context. Winston Smith becomes fascinated with a paperweight, with a coral inside. He says the paperweight was the room he was in, and the coral was Julia's life and his own, fixed in a sort of eternity. at the heart of the crystal. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. This seems to predate the ideas which I'm not acquainted with firsthand, but I was reading about in the Socialist Standard of the, I presume he's an historian called Fukuyama. Fukuyama, if that's the correct pronunciation. But the idea of history having stopped still in a rather different context prefigures this. Let me go on finally to say a few words about criticisms of Orwell, briefly. There is some very pertinent criticism of Orwell's methods in 1984 and elsewhere in Culture and Society by Raymond Williams, part 3, chapter 6. Orwell's principled stand against state capitalism seems to have irked even the most urbane of leftists. And Williams compared Orwell with D.H. Lawrence and went on to deal rather defensively with Orwell's opposition to totalitarianism in these terms. This is Williams. Totalitarian describes a certain kind of repressive social control, but also any real society, any adequate community, is necessarily a totality. To belong to a community is to be part of a whole, and necessarily to accept, while helping to define, its disciplines. To the exile, however, society as such is totalitarian. He cannot commit himself. He is bound to stay out. Now, I think, had Orwell lived to hear Raymond Williams's criticism of him, he may indeed have shouted doublethink, because Orwell's opposition to totalitarianism, I think, is somewhat unfair to be written off as merely the bleatings of an outsider who cannot cope with the demands of belonging to society. However, to his credit, Raymond Williams did then go on to share in Orwell's genuine frustrations that, and I quote, this is Williams again, "the only class in which you can put any hope is written off in present terms as hopeless." Williams also differentiates himself from one critic who had accused Orwell of, I quote, "running shrieking into the arms of the capitalist publishers with a couple of horror comics which bring him fame and fortune." And that's no doubt just one of hundreds of examples of the left who clearly would not have been at all impressed by Orwell's exposure of state capitalist horror. Some other critics have just been plain misinformed, even on the actual text itself. For example, Jeffrey Myers, in his Reader's Guide to George Orwell, refers to the regime as having been anti-Semitic, which is quite untrue. In fact, if you'd have read the text more closely, it's explained in 1984 that the regime has actually expunged itself of all racism in order to become purely class-based in its economic repression. And this, again, was an extremely prescient foresight that Orwell had, realising that as time went on, capitalism, at least to some extent, would find it in its interests to reduce racial tension in order to increase profitability, increase class exploitation. So this description by Myers, that 1984 was presented as an anti-Semitic regime, I don't know where he gets that from. But he goes further in his strange analysis. It makes you wonder if he was reading the same book as us. In 1984, there's a reference to thought crime, which means thinking things you're not supposed to, and you can be arrested for it, but also face crime. And it says in 1984 that face crime means making an improper expression, such as looking incredulous when a victory was announced. So Myers actually says that face crime meant having pronounced Semitic features. So I really wonder what book he was reading. Anyhow, so much for somebody who wrote about the book without probably having read it. Finally, let's look at Isaac Deutscher. Isaac Deutscher wrote a really excellent essay on 1984. It's about the best criticism, certainly of the few that I've read. The essay is called The Mysticism of Cruelty, and it was published in a 1974 collection. What he means by the mysticism of cruelty is that what I was referring to earlier about the seeking after power. He's making the same criticism that I make, that Orwell fails to put things in a proper historical or economic context. He presents this regime as simply being power mad, full stop, for no particular reason, which shows a confused, even demented and hysterical appreciation of what was going on in capitalism in 1948. So hence the mysticism of cruelty, this mystical seeking after cruelty, almost in a sadistic way, in the regime, without any particular economic grounding. He says 1984 is the work of an intense and concentrated, but also fear-ridden and restricted imagination, which I think is an excellent summary of the way in which the book is conceived. Intense but concentrated, but also fear-ridden and restricted imagination. There's a fascinating footnote here, which draws on some personal acquaintance with Orwell. He says that, Isaac Deutscher says that he and Orwell shared a room in a press camp in Germany. He says he was taken back by Orwell's conspiracy theories at the time. His political reasoning struck me as a Freudian sublimation of persecution mania. He was, for instance, unshakably convinced that Stalin, Churchill and Roosevelt consciously plotted to divide the world and to divide it for good among themselves and to subjugate it in common, as in 1984, the three powers. They are all power-hungry, he used to repeat. When once I pointed out to him that underneath the apparent solidarity of the big three, one could discern clearly the conflict between them, already coming to the surface, Orwell was so startled and incredulous that he at once related our conversation in his column in Tribune, and added that he saw no sign of the approach of the conflict of which I spoke. This was by the time of the Yalta conference, or shortly after, when not much foresight was needed to see what was coming. What struck me in Orwell was his lack of historical sense and of psychological insight into political life, coupled with an acute, though narrow, penetration into some aspects of politics and with an incorruptible firmness of conviction. Two or three other things, and I'm going to end in a moment, which Deutscher very usefully points out about Orwell. He basically says that the bitterness or the hysteria of 1984 can be directly traced to the Stalinist Great Purges of 1936 to 1938, the repercussions of which Orwell suffered during his time in Catalonia, which is documented in great detail in his book Homage to Catalonia, with the POUM. That's presented as the origin of Orwell's bitter disillusion. And Deutscher says, for his own part, at the onset of the atomic age, the world is living in a mood of apocalyptic horror. That is why millions of people respond so passionately to the apocalyptic vision of a novelist. The apocalyptic atomic and hydrogen monsters, however, have not been let loose by Big Brother. The chief predicament of contemporary society is that it has not yet succeeded in adjusting its way of life and its social and political institutions to the prodigious advance of its technological knowledge. There, Deutscher, as a literary critic of Orwell, sums up perfectly the socialist project which still awaits fulfilment. And can I end, before we open up an open discussion on all of these issues, can I just finish now by reading yet again from Deutscher this anecdote which he finishes his appraisal on. Have you read this book? You must read it, sir. Then you will know why we must drop the atom bomb on the Bolshies. With these words, a blind, miserable news vendor recommended to me 1984 in New York a few weeks before Orwell's death. Poor Orwell, could he ever imagine that his own book would become so prominent an item in the programme of Hate Week?